You're listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast. Join us for weekly discussions diving into all the particulars of communication, voice, swallow, and cognition with tangible applications to the world of medical speech and language pathology. Additional resources and the discussion guide are in specially curated show notes on speechuncensored.com. I'm excited to sit down with Abby Simon and dive into the clinical management of chronic cases. As an outpatient SLP, this is such a huge deal for me, and I'm really looking forward to hearing Abby's perspective. And there's a lot to unpack here. She's doing more than just talking about chronic cases. So let's get started. My name is Leanne Porter. I'm your host. And now let's welcome Abby. Hi, Abby.
Hi, Leanne. It's nice to see you today.
It's nice to see you too. I'm really, as I mentioned, like literally 2 seconds ago, I am really excited for this. Knowing when to say goodbye. When do we ever talk about this? When do we ever learn about this? Like, wrapping things up was a huge hurdle for me in my practice. So I am really excited for this conversation.
I love the way you said that it was a hurdle for you at some point, or is still a hurdle for you at some point, because like you said, we don't talk about it much. I think nowadays, even after 24 or 5 years of being a speech therapist, when I engage in continuing education or try to learn more about the clinical work that I do, we don't really discuss discharge planning or how to break up or how to say goodbye, especially with clients who have quote unquote chronic illnesses. I think it's different for clinicians who are working in outpatient settings or even inpatient settings where discharge planning is set at the forefront due to different constraints, either from a public school or an institution. But for those of us that are in private practice, we have a little more flexibility, and that final goodbye isn't always set out as clearly as I think it should be.
Yeah, I agree. And I love that you like slipped in there like it's a breakup, because that's going to be something else that we touch on, is like this relationship that we form, and how sometimes in some cases our patients can form a certain type of attachment or dependency that we need to be aware of.
You are hitting all my nails already with a hammer.
All right, excellent. Okay, so let's dive in. I want to learn a little bit more about you. So tell me who you are, where you are, and what you do.
Thank you for asking. I am Abby Simon. I am a speech pathologist. I've been fortunate enough to work in probably every setting possible that a speech therapist can work in, from outpatient to inpatient to skilled nursing to assisted living to acute care, where else, to wonderful aphasia groups and centers in the country and small private practices. And then 2 years ago, I decided to open a private practice here in North Carolina. I know I don't sound Southern. I am a native New Yorker who went to school at the University of Buffalo for undergrad and graduate school, and had the instinct at the time that I knew was my calling, which was to work with adults who have acquired neurogenic communication disorders. And I find myself, even after all these years, committed to, passionate about, and, you know, finding new ways to work with people that have communication disorders that they've acquired and how to continue their life in a healthy, happy, and fulfilled way, despite whatever challenges they're facing.
Excellent.
I created this program in North Carolina because I began to really research and understand the impact of intensity. And as you may know, and lots of the listeners are probably aware of, intensive comprehensive aphasia programming, or ICAPS, are a way that people with aphasia, which is my big area of interest, considered to be a chronic condition, lies. And while I do see people with other communication impairments, aphasia is at the forefront of what I do. And North Carolina, while we have a great hub of people interested in researching aphasia, we don't have an intensive option. So I've created something based on my interest in relationships called a relationship-centered aphasia program that I call RCAP, which could be sort of a double play on words, R for relationship and R like O-U-R. It's our program to work on your aphasia and include the other hours or people in your life so that the aphasia is addressed not only by the person who has it, because as our great Audrey Holland says, aphasia is a family problem. And I like to say that aphasia, like a lot of other chronic conditions, does not just affect the person that has it, which is how I became really interested in this concept of relationship-centered care. And one more part of my professional life that I love is being a group leader for the Triangle Aphasia Project. I run the Intensive Aphasia Program, which is a daily opportunity for clients to come and have 3 hours or 4 hours of aphasia programming. And then I run some individual groups as well. So in addition to that, last thing about myself is that I'm currently almost finished with getting a certification in health coaching. And I'm really looking forward to that because A, I love learning about health, but most importantly, it is to help the clients I work with who may feel that their health has changed as a result of what they've acquired due to brain injury or, you know, other medical illness, and be able to help them find health, happiness, and wellness even though their life has changed in an unpredictable way. So I'm looking forward to that being a way that I can balance my work further.
That's cool. Yeah, that's a very like holistic approach. I really like that. So you, in your intro, you talked a little bit about focusing on that like relationship-centered care. So let's unpack that a little bit more.
Okay. So I think for those of us that are trending in the literature and goal writing, we are finding ourselves thinking about client-centered, person-centered, family-centered ways of writing goals or thinking about plans of care that aren't driven by necessarily what the impairment is based on or what the therapist thinks that they should write the goals about. And so relationship-centered takes those client-led goals and thinks about all the people that could be involved in the person's continuum. And there have been some very well-known studies that talk about this phrase, relationship-centered care, having to do with a medical model. It wasn't really until like the 1980s that we started to hear about this person-centered care. And I think we could wonder, well, then what was happening before something was person or patient-centered? Was it doctor-led? Was it clinician-dictated? Shouldn't we always be thinking about the person or the client first? And in the mid-1990s, there was a task force based in the University of California in San Francisco called the Pugh-Fetzer Task Force that described the relationship-centered care in detail. And I'm not going to read it because it will take a lot of time, but I want to highlight a couple of the main points that I think are important for people to consider, which is that healthcare, as it's changing, whether it's because people are living longer, whether it's because insurance demands are changing, we have to think of health, according to what they say, not as the absence of disease, but rather as the process by which individuals maintain their sense of coherence in a meaningful way, and that they can function as they face changes in themselves and in the relationships with their environment and other people. So I think it's important for health professionals, no matter what kind of professional we are, to always consider and interpret a person's needs based on who else is in their life. And sometimes finding those relationships isn't easy. You know, I keep referring to this medical model, but I want to mention speech therapists and other helping professionals who by nature, I think you'd probably agree, we're empaths. And there's a reason why we chose the field that we're in. And whether we knew about it when we decided to major in what we majored in, but we have a little bit more perception, per se, than someone who might be in sales or legal negotiating types of professions. So I think an empath by nature wants to figure out how people are feeling and how we can change possible factors that are influencing some negative emotions or feelings by our nature, right? Do you agree with that?
Yes.
We're not corporations. We are sensitive people that take home our jobs even when we close our eyes at night and lay on the pillow. We're thinking about our clients no matter what.
You know, like yes and no, because I feel like I'm empathic in the moment, but I'm oddly good at separating. I always call it, this is probably an overgeneralization of this statement, but like a separation of church and state. So like, there's my work and then there's my life. Now, the underlying currents of how work is going and maybe the stressors involved at work or what I'm carrying for my patients while I'm at work, like that may trail with me into my home life, but I don't really think back to certain types of things and try to unpack that when I'm at home.
So I'm probably more of the opposite, which is probably why this whole notion, not necessarily because I like acronyms, but clinicians conquering chronic cases has been something that has been swirling around in my mind for years. And whether it's certain conferences that I go to or talks that I hear or things that I read, I struggle with it. And frankly, I never envisioned this topic as being a podcast per se, but much more as a discussion. Mm-hmm. I crave talking about this to other clinicians, not because I want to learn from each other. So hearing you say this separation of church and state, where there's me who, when I'm out, I could be in a restaurant or at a car dealership and I can think about something a client has talked to me about. And I'm thinking about that client saying, oh, I better text or take a picture of and let this person know. So I think perhaps it is worth me exploring more about the relationship that I create, because we'll talk about in a little, but one of the relationship-centered relationships, if you will, is the relationship between we clinicians or practitioners and the client, and we clinicians with each other, et cetera. There's four different types. So I think my relationships sometimes, and I don't mean all, maybe I do get too invested or care a little bit too much, dare I say, that I don't put my head on the pillow at night and think only about things unrelated. So see, I can learn from you talking about your ability to do so.
You know, I think that that makes me think, like, in just all my relationships, relationships with friends, family, work, professional relationships and work, like, you know, with other clinicians, and then like with our patient population, it seems like you're the type of person who, like, when you make that relationship, like with your friends, you'll be out in public and something will remind you of your friend and you'll want to take a picture and text it to your friend. Just like the same, you'll be thinking something will remind you of your patient and you'll want to send that to your patient. Mm-hmm. And that rarely happens to me. I think I just have a different relationship mindset built, you know? And so,
well, so that's a great segue, because when we look at the review of the literature, according to this Pew Fetzer report, they talk about four dimensions of relationships. And like I said, one is the patient to the clinician. I consider us clinicians. So we have clients, we're the clinician. We have colleagues, we have clinicians to clinicians, practitioners to practitioners. We then have our role as clinician to the community, whether that be our medical community, whether it be our support, our colleagues, whomever. And then we have this relationship with ourself. It's like self-awareness. And this is when I sort of think about my health coaching tricks and tools and strategies, because we as clinicians need our own self-care and reflection. And this short conversation that you and I have had thus far has already allowed me to reflect in a way that I will hang up thinking, I will mull over my perception of the relationships I have with my clients. And maybe I do need to delineate it a little bit more. Or maybe, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that our ability to reflect on how we are with each individual case in a way that we may not if we just check boxes and go through a therapy session to get from the beginning to the end. So I'm glad we're sharing our differences.
It is. It's funny because, like, you're thinking, oh, maybe I need to, like, maybe take a step back. And I'm like, maybe I need to take a step forward. Let's meet in the middle.
So we got to find a happy medium.
I know, right?
Well, then you probably won't relate to this fact either then. But maybe you will. And I think self-reflection isn't something a lot of health professionals think they need to do for themselves, but it's an important way to grow and better ourselves and those we serve. So that's one point. But the other point is thinking about, again, your church and state comparison, is thinking about us as healers, per se, or curers. We're helpers, right? We're the ones, I mean, how many of our clients call us teachers? And again, I'm focusing on aphasia, but I really believe that this chronic condition or the chronic communication disorder could be people with other neurogenic progressive diseases, right? We have Parkinson's patients. We have progressive disorders of brain changes. There's other chronic illnesses that people have until, unfortunately, they pass away, as opposed to the temporary communication disorders that we do see in a school or an outpatient setting, a post-concussive syndrome, a voice disorder, even some dysphagias, disfluencies. So I just want to make sure that I'm not negating other communication disorders while focusing a lot on aphasia. It's just one that to me stands out as one of the biggest chronic conditions. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah.
So being this healer or the one that people learn to rely on, we really can't be viewed as separate from the person we are quote unquote healing, quote unquote serving. Or, you know, in some of the articles, they consider people with a condition that's chronic a sufferer, which I don't like considering clients I have as suffering per se, but we as the healer and they as the sufferer, we're not separate independent units. And I think the relationship that we construct with one another allows us to develop skills and knowledge so that the value in the therapeutic relationship can grow and depend on things other than the success of a person's communication goals. And one of the four things that this Pugh and Fetzer task force highlight is the ability to develop and maintain relationships with patients. So when I read about relationship-centered care and one of these facets, other ones include like the patient's experience of their health and wellness, their self-awareness and continuing to grow, and communicating clearly and effectively, what stands out most in my mind is this developing and maintaining the relationship, which ties into if we deepen it so much, if we focus so much on our relationship, does that impact the discharge plan and breakup? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I've married the two interests of mine.
You know, I was also like, while I was listening, I was reflecting. And I was like, I think one of the reasons too, why I don't dive too deep, like I want a positive working relationship. And I want them to know I'm invested in them so that they feel that and are motivated to participate and to share with me on this like hardworking journey we're about to embark on. But I know that this is where I feel like I'm more of an empath. Like if I go too deep, like I'll feel too much and it will become too overwhelming. So it's almost like a self-preservation technique to do a measure of the separation of church and
boundary.
State.
And that, right. And the boundary is important. You know, in therapeutic relationships, we talk about boundaries or this concept of transference. How much of us should we be sharing with our clients? And it's interesting. I don't see a heck of a lot of voice patients, but I'm working with someone now who has muscle tension dysphonia. And I have in a short time admitted to him that I am a culprit of using some of those maladaptive behaviors. And I think when I admitted it to him or even showed him a little bit of my improper breathing during a session, he was like, oh, cool. And like just adding that little piece, I knew that it did something to our quote unquote relationship. I was not the teacher, the healer, the curer. I was another person that had some experience professionally to guide him, but the relatability factor was good, which we don't really see in other types of communication disorders unless, you know, I mean, so voice is probably a rare opportunity for clinicians to admit that they can really relate, I guess. Well, that's probably not true the more I think about it, but I liked that I could share that without giving him too much information. So it also makes me think when you're saying, you know, how much we invest of ourselves in these cases, I just would like to highlight that I think it's dependent on our work environment. And it wasn't until I really became a private practitioner and or group leader in aphasia centers that I realized I didn't have the time constraints or the productivity pressure of an organization or institution requiring me to reach certain numbers or telling me that there was a vibrant waiting list of people that needed services. Because I work for myself, I have the luxury of extending the care sometimes beyond what it would in a more traditional outpatient corporate situation. And that has allowed me also to question the process of maintaining and terminating therapy with clients who, in my opinion, could effectively require therapy for a lot of their life. Recently, I was listening to somebody talk. This is a young gentleman I know who had a stroke intraoperatively when he was having some cardiac surgery. And when I worked with him, really, he used his phone with a Ogcom app to communicate most of his language. And I listened to him in the last few days and my I was listening to it as I was running, and I had to stop a couple of times because I could not get over. So he had his stroke in 2007. So it's like 14 years later. I must have last seen him 7 years ago. So in the last 7 or 8 years, he was speaking nearly fluently. And I had this moment where I was like, this is why I cannot say goodbye to my clients, because at least with aphasia, I know that there's always potential for improvement. I could always justify the need to change, adapt, or revise a goal. But is that my responsibility? Is that relationship one that I should continue to foster? So that's where my whole struggle with how to conquer these cases sets in, about when to say someone else should step in and do the things that I've been helping you do.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like sometimes when you've worked for a period of time with someone, you feel like you've given, you know, all the tricks in your bag, all the recommendations, they've used them, you know, they're on par, but you feel like you're approaching that discharge time, but they're stating very clearly like, oh, they want more. They like this. They want to continue. And you're like, I'm not sure what I have next for you. Is that when you're like, there are other SLPs out there? Like, you can get a brand new brain on this?
So this is the issue. When we work with clients who come in and we get to know them and we quote unquote informally or formally assess, and we think about patient reported outcomes, or we look at goal attainment scaling, we do all these things to address a client's needs, right? Going back to this client-centered, person-centered care, which I so believe in. I think sometimes if people were to watch me in a session, they might think, and sometimes I joke with my students, like, this might not look like a speech therapy session, but speech therapy is really just about talking and doing things that matter. But during those initial moments, minutes, or even sessions, I will admit that I don't talk about discharge anytime in the initial stages. Yes, when we write our plans of care, we need to express where we think this treatment needs to go X amount of times a week, for X amount of weeks or month, for a total of X amount of sessions. Whether that's an insurance pressure or what we've been trained to do, it's certainly part of our standard of care. But I don't typically say, unless it's perhaps a voice case or an LSVT case, that we have X amount of sessions that I think we can accomplish your goals in. Because with aphasia, the long-term goals should be general enough and functional enough. But beneath those long-term goals, I find the short-term goals evolve as progress is made. And so I've always refrained, and again, maybe it's something I need to be better about, which is why I want this discussion, is to have a clearer idea about how the discharge plan will be. And I've asked questions to therapists, colleagues, to say, what's the longest you've ever worked with someone? You know, like, how do you know if it's been too long? And we know there are cases, people have gotten therapy for years. I will admit that I've worked with some clients for years. I will admit that if you looked at my documentation, there is nothing to prove that it's not justified, that everything I am doing is a justifiable, medically necessary target. But that's what I'll sort of lead into here, is talking about this breakup process. So I just want to go back a second to another relationship-centered care framework, which in 2006, I think this is a good reference and I'll share it with you, talks about how relationship-centered care is defined further and how it was founded upon four principles. And these are doctors from Johns Hopkins named Drs. Catherine Beach and Thomas Inouye. And it talks about relationship-centered care being 4 points. Number one, relationships in healthcare ought to include the personhood of the participants. We've talked about that. That affect and emotion are important components of these relationships. That all healthcare relationships occur in the context of reciprocal influence, which goes back to we are just as equal in our relationship with our client. And that the formation and maintenance of genuine relationships in healthcare is morally valuable. And that word genuine sort of resonates with me when I think of us as empaths. I don't know about you. I definitely consider myself a genuine therapist. And I think that my clients know that the relationship I have with them is far from phony and just something I'm doing to pass the time or get paid, because that's not the case. Relationships between us and our clients remain central and they evolve. So with that, I'm going to segue into thinking about our relationships as one of the domains in something called the aphasia framework for outcome measures, which I know you've had other therapists on the podcast talk about aphasia and living with aphasia and the life participation model. And one of the domains of what's called the AFROM is participation in life situations. And this is where relationships come into play. And when we as clinicians talk to our clients about the relationships in their lives, we talk about their doctors, their family members, their friends, and their colleagues, people that they may want to get in touch with. But I believe that in the initial phases of our relationship forming, we should talk about the relationship between us, between I'm the clinician, I have certain expectations, this is how I'm going to help you, this is what I hope to receive, or you know, I hope that you could commit to. And so I'd like to include that more when I'm starting off with a new client, which I can add to something that I always give a client, which is this diagram that I call like, who are the people in your neighborhood? Because I guess who doesn't know Mr. Rogers, right? And I don't know if it was when the movie came out a few years ago that I started to think about that even before I dove into RCC or relationship-centered care, was we need to think about our clients as having a neighborhood and who is in their neighborhood besides their primary communication partner, spouse, or child, and me, the therapist that they come to with such, you know, hope and saying, this is the person that's going to make it all better. So I give the client a pictograph with them in the center and then bubbles and lines around it and say, let's talk about all the important relationships in your life. Because our therapy isn't going to be just about you saying X, Y, and Z. It's going to be about improving, maintaining, or creating new relationships. And hopefully those people will buy into the fact that the aphasia or other chronic condition is impacting them because it impacts you. So I think I need to, again, as I'm not just lecturing here, I'm discussing, and if there were people who were talking back besides the two of us, maybe they would say to me, yeah, Abby, you definitely should in the early stages of your assessment talk about those relationships and include you as a primary one. So that is one highlight to consider when forming our goals and expectations. When I started to research, and let me say that I should have said in the beginning, I'm not a research SLP. I'm quite a clinical SLP who looks at research, but more so learns about it from other people. But when I started to put this information together for talks and documents that I've shared with other people, I was sort of disappointed. And even, you know, going back to think about wonderful aphasiology mentors that I have and talks that they've given, I really can't find much information about how people with aphasia view discharge planning, what the process is like for clinicians, and are there studies that have shown different ways of doing it and how that has led to outcomes. And fortunately, we have wonderful colleagues in Australia at the University of Queensland, and those wonderful women are Drs. Linda Worrell and Deborah Hirsch. And I get totally consumed by a lot of their writing. And I don't know if you've read or are familiar with them, but they are the ones that talk most about this topic that I'm interested in, that I hope I can share with other American SLPs and we can talk about when we have conferences in person again. But Dr. Worrell talks about, and she has a very well-known publication in 2019 that's called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Aphasia Therapists. And this is not the time to go through each of them. It's certainly worth people reading because I don't think it has to apply only to people who work with clients who have aphasia. But the one habit that relates to what you and I are talking about is habit number 1, which says that effective therapists prioritize relationships with people living with aphasia. So that stood out in my mind because I said, this is what I do. I do prioritize relationships with my clients who have aphasia. And I assume my colleagues and those who are listening today do that as well. Because like I said before, aphasia therapists are affected by their client. Well, I said it in different ways, but aphasia therapists are affected by their clients as much as the client is affected by the therapist. And that I think is inevitable. So, like I said earlier, is this why I think about my clients even when I'm not with them? Because they're part of my neighborhood. And so when I think about that, who's in your neighborhood, I identify myself as a mom and as a friend and as a daughter and as a spouse and as a person that does yoga, but I identify myself as a speech pathologist who prides herself on the relationships I have with my clients that I think sometimes becomes really significant to the point where discharge planning becomes a problem. So that's leading up to this next and hopefully nearing our next subtopic of how do we say goodbye and how much of our patients' influence contributes to this process. Okay. So as I mentioned before, we talk about our goals, but whether or not we are talking about what is your goal about stopping therapy is the question. I'll be curious, when you meet with your clients in different settings, do you ever, probably in an inpatient setting, we could say, I'll see you until you're discharged. And when you are discharged, I'll give you some recommendations for some outpatient therapists or some aphasia centers or other support groups that could help you. But how often are we bringing up the plan of care to include our discharge when our course of treatment has begun? Can you think about any of that yourself? I don't know.
Well, when I'm in outpatient and they're coming in for their initial evaluation, they often have the question like, how long will this last? How often will I see you? How long will our sessions be? They want to have an expectation about what's coming in the future. So I got into the habit in outpatient of thinking in groups of 10 because our facility had this habit of when they scheduled the evaluation, they scheduled 8 to 10 sessions just to lock them in so they had a place to initiate their therapy and go forward before their spot got taken with something else. And then plus in Medicare, they have that requirement about like every 10th visit, you need to write a progress note. So I would just tell people at the outset, like, let's see how you are in 10 sessions. Like, let's get started and see where we go from there. Mm-hmm. And other therapists that I've talked with have gotten me to think about like beginning with the end in mind. Mm-hmm. So like, what does the end look like? How long do you anticipate it would take to achieve that goal? So it's just been kind of a mesh because I don't want to overwhelm people by being like, oh, honey, it's going to take months. You're going to be here months. It's going to be forever. Right. Settle in, right. You know? And maybe some people want to hear that. I don't know. But other people, I find we are very impatient as human beings and we want to get better like yesterday, you know? And we might have a slightly kind of warped perspective about how quickly our bodies will heal and how quickly we'll, quote, get back to normal. Yeah. And so I've gotten into the habit of just doing the sets of 10.
And I think one of our colleagues who talks about starting with the end, it makes so much sense, right? Let's not worry about how we're going to get there. Let's worry about where we want to be. And I think where we want to be also needs to include, I want to be independent of my therapist. And again, it goes back to this relationship. I know I'm saying relationship like 4,000 times, but it's that the depth of and the intensity of, and it does not happen with all clients. Someone that walks, I mean, people's personalities, as we know, don't usually change with these communication disorders, right? So there are going to be people that come into my therapy room and say, like, I'm here because my doctor told me to be, and when am I going to be done? And then there are people who are like, oh my God, in these first 15 minutes, this woman's going to change me. I'm never going to leave. And there are people whose lives you become part of and who have other people in their lives that I have helped learn about aphasia so that the husband could get the wife an anniversary card and therefore the daughter had to help the husband realize, you know, it's like all these relationships that we then get ourselves involved in happily. So starting with the end maybe needs to say, it's really hard for me to predict how long it's going to take for you to reach even this first basic goal. But I think you're going to get there. And maybe when this goal is reached, you'll be fine and you'll be satisfied. And we'll revisit that and you'll tell me a story about what you think and we'll do a little testing and we'll use some subjective measures. But we need to say, like, let's also talk about this discharge plan. So this is when tension arises in our relationship. There are these tense, forced decisions that ensue from the relationship developing, creating, and being solidified. Whether it be 2 months, I mean, 10 sessions seems like a dreamy yet sort of unrealistic way to envision at least therapy for someone that has chronic care. And I often joke and say that if someone really saw what number session I was on for some of my clients, they may say, Abby, again, like, you've been seeing this client for sessions? I'm like, yes, I have. And I could see him for another 15, maybe. And we'll talk about ways to change that. So these tensions that come up are often between the clinician, we, and the person with the aphasia or other chronic condition, and or their communication partners or family members. So yikes, it's like, I'm going to pull this way, you're going to pull this way. They want to stop therapy, I think they need more. The family member is like, no, we can't stop now, you've really made progress. The client's like, but no, I just want to sit home and watch TV or play with my Legos. And so without the positive relationship between us and our client and the collaborative approach to doing that, there have been these studies done from Australia that show that clients feel a higher level of uncertainty about discharge and after discharge if there wasn't a better connection between client and the clinician, or clinician and other people in the client's life. And it seems like, of course, right? I mean, we're not just going to say, okay, it's time for you to go. There has to be sort of a weaning process. And so again, when should this weaning process begin? And we mentioned earlier what it's like to work for more institutionalized employers when their expectation, length of stay, their policies on limited therapy with Medicare, like you mentioned before, there used to be a cap and we could only spend a certain amount of dollars, but how dare they take away that, you know, right from our clients, and we would write letters to justify ongoing therapy, and we'd have to wait for the insurance company to get back to us, or some private insurance companies only give X amount of sessions a year. We have to think about how that influences our discharge plan. Lots of people have waiting lists. Oh, does a client sense that a clinician's like, oh, I gotta discharge you and move you along because I've got other people waiting to see me? And I had a client once say to me in my office, she brought in her brother. We were working with a young person and we were trying to think of the next time they would all come in. And I heard the mom say, oh, but you know, Abby, she's always very busy. And I was like, yikes, that's not how I want them to feel. I want them to feel like, no, she's got all the time. I can find a time to fit him. And that was, again, good self-awareness and reflection for me to hear that. And I think, like I said too earlier, was I think the setting that we work in also impacts how we say goodbye. And emotions play into this. Our emotions as well as our clients' emotions. And if we think, regardless of their age, this concept that toddlers deal with called separation anxiety, I think plays a part in many clients getting ready to be discharged from, whether it's physical therapy and knowing that they're not going to have as much physical support and guarding when they say goodbye to their physical therapist, or our therapist saying, what happens when I'm not able to join the guys at the poker game, but my therapist and I used to role play those situations. And if we say goodbye to each other and she's not there to help me, they can get anxious about it. So again, thinking about what's to come earlier on is important. We know that aphasia could be very isolating, and that the relationships we create with our clients form or reduce their level of solitude, right? Because whether it's once a week, twice a week, or in my case, sometimes I work with people intensively, it's like comforting to know they're not alone because they're going to be with us. And this emotion of feeling rejected or abandoned. If my therapist tells me that therapy is coming to an end, oh my God, she thinks I'm not going to get better. She thinks, or he thinks, I'm getting worse and they're rejecting me and now I'm going to be abandoned. And will I be able to get another therapist? Are they going to recommend I get another therapist? Or they're feeling disappointment or worry and fear, or maybe they feel like they've been a burden to us. They've been with us too long and they feel guilty. So I think there's so many of these emotions that come into play. And again, coming back to aphasia, we as clinicians always stress, I hope our clinicians stress, that with aphasia, there ain't no thing as plateauing. So we could say, I could continue doing therapy with aphasia. Yes, a recovery is possible, but with recovery comes ups and downs. We're never, you know, we may see a little blip above a quote unquote stagnant line, but there's no such thing as capping out and not being able to constantly improve. So these emotions that play in on our part, because I think we as clinicians could feel guilty and stress about discharging a person, are ways that influence our plan for discharge. You know, thinking about this concept of hope, and does discharge mean that hope is lost? Does discharge mean that progress is no longer possible? And does discharge mean that the relationship we've created with this therapist who now we trust is broken? No, we have to hopefully, again, bio-individual cases, everybody is different. We don't have the same connection with each of our clients, but we need to make sure someone knows that saying goodbye doesn't mean that there's no more hope, purpose, or possibility.
You know, as you've been going down these items, it's made me think like the need for having like open, frank conversations is really crucial. You know, like if they have a fear about discharge and what it means for them, we need to discuss that. If we can sense that they're having anxiety, if we bring up like future discharge dates or achievements that we're anticipating to indicate time for discharge, like we need to talk about their fears and suss those out. And then you talked about like the hope involved in that too, but also like the loss of hope. Like you said, like if she's talking about discharge, does that mean this is it for me? Another like couple conversations I've had on the podcast have been giving our patients the tools to become their own clinician. So empowering them that they no longer need us anymore. So they enjoy our company because we're such delightful people. But the goal is always, you know, to empower them so that they know the tools, they have the tools, and they can use them.
And
empowering their neighborhood and their network of communicators.
And I start and end all my cases, if you will, with this concept of help. And I don't mean help like save me. I mean home exercise language program, which means I give you this help, quote unquote, when we meet, and you take that help when we say goodbye. And it could be tweaked by you or whomever else is in your neighborhood or life. I will always be there as your help, but you can do it without me. But I think the last part I wanted to mention was reasons for discharge. And so how, when we're conquering these cases, what could we consider? Well, there's the client-centered reasons. The client reasons might be, and these are just some I could think of, maybe it's money, maybe it's the insurance that's capped out. Maybe it's convenience. It's inconvenient now. Transportation, motivation has waned. Family support has changed. Perception of recovery has changed. Maybe they thought, I'm only going to come for 5 weeks. And they're like, oh my gosh, after 3 weeks, stuff's happening. I'm going to stick around a little longer. Or after 3 weeks, they think this clinician doesn't know what she's doing and I've got to find somebody else that can make better achievements. Any changes in their medical care? How satisfied do they feel? Or I remember a client, quite a nonverbal client, drawing a picture and what he eventually said was a wall. He hit a wall. He said we had made so much progress. And then there came a point where he was, and I realized it too. Okay, now where do we go? And I had to say to myself, could another therapist who doesn't know this gentleman come in with a new perspective? I mean, we as therapists, right, we only have a certain number of tricks in our bag. But our personalities, our approaches, the newness, that could, you know, add another level of therapy to a client's rehab journey. So I think that we have to sometimes admit as clinicians that there may be somebody else that could still do it. And we have to be selfless and say, it's good, it's convenient, I could make money this way, but we have to know when it's fairer to pass the client along. So those are the client-centered reasons. And some clinician-centered reasons could be institutional guidelines, right? You can only see a person for this amount of time. There's no other intervention available at this time. I've done everything I could. And that's when I think about what you said earlier, you know, when clients, not that they don't have a plateau, but when we think about someone who's getting LSVT, for example, we know from the get-go they're going to get 16 or 20 sessions. They know when their treatment's going to end. Or the children that have artic goals or the children that have pragmatic issues, you know, they're seen in other situations in classrooms and it's probably a little bit more predictable. So clinicians may have better reasons for discharging. But with these other chronic cases, we too could feel like a wall has been hit, that we've reached a level of, dare I say, boredom or stagnation, that I've done everything I can and maybe a new perspective is better. I think there's something about boundaries too. We talked about earlier where maybe that relationship has gotten a little too close. I mean, I'll admit I have a client from years ago who I don't see anymore. He knew enough about one of my sons who was learning how to golf. And I had to make a decision about whether or not to introduce the client to my son. It was actually separate of me, but my client met my son at a golf range. That might have, I don't know, was that a boundary? I wasn't. I think I picked up my son, but that was a sign too, like, has our relationship changed? Listen, you didn't even go onto a golf course before we started working together. Now you've not only gone onto a golf course, you're showing my son how to golf. So your aphasia has come a long way. I have that to actually look back at. So questioning our boundaries. And we also might feel scared to say goodbye to our clients. We may feel guilty, like, I'm too scared to say goodbye because then they'll judge me and they'll think that this clinician didn't make the best decision. And then we have these external reasons for discharge planning, which are if someone relocates, if there's time restrictions and scheduling problems, if, like I said earlier, medical situations or statuses change, those two would obviously play into a final way of knowing that the end of care has come to a point. And I think one of the articles that Deborah Hirsch wrote said, there's a quote that says, even though we are communication experts, we speech pathologists, that is, we may not explain the discharge plan well enough. Is discharge planning bad news? Or is it something to be proud of and accomplished? Should it be viewed as an achievement? So I think, again, doing some of that self-perception, self-reflection, we have to acknowledge and maybe admit to our clients and ourselves that weaning and discharge planning may not come to us as clearly as other things do when we're trying to impact clients' lives. Mm-hmm. That's the things I think about when I ponder this type of work that we do. And I really do hope there could be a time when I and other people could sit together and discuss it. Well, this is what I do, and this is what you do, and maybe you should try this, or would this work? So I do hope that this conversation that you and I had could spark some others to talk about it in other conferences or virtual platforms.
Yeah, I hope so. Because something I'm doing with each podcast episode now is creating a discussion guide for SLPs to come together who have listened to the episode and talk a little bit more in depth about the topic and do their own sharing and relating. And so with the additional questions that you've provided, you know, we're going to make a discussion guide for that so people can sit together and continue to unpack this topic. So you're going to get your wish.
Okay. Thank you for doing this in all your spare free time.
You know, you said something earlier in our talk that I wanted to touch on again before we wrap up, because it really touches on like a professional insecurity that I think we can fall trap to. And it's the, when you mentioned like, oh, you've been seeing somebody for, and I'll make up a number, like, oh, 45 sessions? Like, whoa, that's a lot. Like, why have you been seeing them for 45 sessions? And that might make clinicians feel like, what, am I moving too slowly? Should I be more efficient with this patient? No, that, like, let me squash that lie right now. Like, you move at the speed that's appropriate for that patient, and don't think that someone could do it faster than you or anything like that. Like, you are a responsible clinician and you are moving at the speed that's appropriate for that patient, for their needs. So I don't want people to get that worm in their ear that 45 sessions is too much. It is patient dependent.
And not only is it based on time, it comes back to values and needs, and people's communication goals change, they evolve. So if we're working on script training, for example, and the goal was that the person could introduce themselves and state their date of birth, let's say, I don't know, very basic. And then they've done like 3 or 4 scripts in a month, and you're like, wait a minute, this person could even give a speech or go back to work or order all the food for their family in a restaurant. Wow, I can add a new goal, a more complex goal for this person. And now that they've done script training, we can do response elaboration. There's all these things. Now, of course, we could keep creating goals and finding evidence-based ways to do it. So that goes back to, okay, you have the resources, you have the quote-unquote help. I've given you the tools, and now you have to take this out on your own. So 45 sessions or 95 sessions or 5 sessions, hopefully the clinician who's made that determination is doing it with the client's best interest in heart and not for any other reason, like, for money, for filling their schedule. I mean, that really and hopefully should never be the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, on the flip side of that, like you also kind of mentioned, like a long time with a patient being related to well, you need to get them off your schedule so you can make room for that wait list that's coming behind mm-hmm. you, right? So there's all of these things at play, and we can really, I feel like, fall into this trap of forgetting what's best for the patient.
Right. And while I miss daily interaction with professional colleagues because I have a private practice now, I have the good fortune of being able to have a little bit more flexibility with that. I'm thinking of a client that we could just sort of wrap up by talking about who I didn't meet until 10 years after his stroke. Mm. Every month I always say to my clients, all right, let's talk about, and this is maybe something I should discuss, but I think, all right, so let's talk about next month's schedule. How do you feel about it? Do you think we should continue, or should we reduce the number of sessions we're having, et cetera? So this client that I met 10 years post-stroke, basically all he said was thank you, thank you, thank you. And he could communicate quite well with those two words. I have seen him for under a year, once a week, not twice, through Zooming. And at the end of every month when I talk to him about what's to come next month, because I'm feeling like discharge is imminent, but I am a really supportive outlet for him that has given him this awareness of, oh my, the man speaks in sentences. Mm. Now, he doesn't have the opportunity to speak in sentences because he doesn't have many relationships in his life that during the pandemic he was able to at least rely on. Now that he can go into the dining room at his assisted living and he sits with one other woman, he's working towards saying, do you have plans today? And he could ask me that once a week. He could even say, how are you doing? And he feels like he's just accomplished, you know, a scientific breakthrough. But he has. And he sees the potential that he has. He doesn't have relationships to do it with. So I believe that him saying goodbye to me maybe shouldn't be a question I ask him. It should be, look, sir, you have come this far. You can say all these things. I enjoy working with you. We can constantly can create new sentences and phrases for you to acquire. But I think it's time that we say goodbye. It's equally admittedly hard for me because I can justify the support that I give him. So these are the problems I face as an experienced clinician working with clients whose disorders don't go away after X amount of months.
I found something that's helped, also things I've learned on the podcast, you know, having these conversations are, you know, my new obsession, patient reported outcome measures, because in these patients with chronic communication disorders, there is always something we can work on. And so at some point we have to decide when we've finished. And so the patient reported outcome measures, I feel like, reinforce when we give it to them at the beginning and toward the middle and towards the end of our time together, they can see how their views on communication have changed, how their confidence has changed, how their abilities have changed. And I think that helps put them in the spot of recognizing all the work that they've put into that and all their achievements to let them know that, sure, there's things that we can continue to work on. But again, if we've, you know, begun with the end in mind and we've equipped them to become the clinician, then they feel empowered to continue that progress on the other side.
Right. And right. And again, to make sure that that is so true. And I love giving those, and to make sure that the other people in their lives are present for that discussion.
Yeah.
So I think that that's key too. And let's also remember that certain levels of communication make that type of discussion hard to have. So different levels of severity might make the ability to really express those thoughts a little bit more challenging. So when we're repeating those measures, we have to make sure that we're using whatever communication supports and aids and choices will allow the person with the condition to be as explicit as they can when sharing those feelings and making those decisions with us.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Great point to not forget to use those PROMs, you know, at different points in the therapy.
I feel like I should add to my resume, like, PROMs ambassador. Like, I'm just like obsessed with getting everybody to use PROMs.
Yes. And again, trying to make sure, and there's better ones that are suited for people with different levels of language impairment. So, and it's hard when you're the clinician trying to provide communication support and knowing it's like an assessment, a self-assessment, not using too much support to sway them and how to answer, but like try to simplify it as well as we can so that they could have as reliable of an outcome as possible.
Yeah. Well, all right, Abby, is that everything that you wanted to cover for our chat today?
And I can always talk for a long time, but I think we really did discuss openly and honestly a topic that, like I said, isn't a how-to. Mm-hmm. It's more of a discussion. Mm-hmm. It's more of something to let us clinicians think about maybe before it's time to really pull the trigger, if you will, and to admit that we don't always have the right answer, that we need to collaborate with other people that are facing the decision of discharge, like the client and their family members. And maybe for me, at least, to take a more of a risk in saying, we're done. Like we've reached this point of satisfaction, or even more than satisfaction. I'm always here for you, right? We have to say goodbye and discharge, but let somebody know that we are a resource that will be there until we mm-hmm. are no longer really needed or thought of.
Yeah. That's something I would always do at every last session with a patient, was I would make sure that they had my work contact information. Mm-hmm. So if I had a card, I would give them the card that would have like my work phone and my work email on it. And I would let them know, like, if you had thoughts or questions or something changes, like, reach out, give me a call. Like, I, just because you're not coming in every week doesn't mean like I can't assist you with something in the future. And I think when people feel that they have that opening, it's also very reassuring, and it helps with that breakup, you know?
Yeah. But then it's like, too, like I can look at my phone right now and I'll get like random texts sometimes, you know, maybe it gives, you know, and I have like a text recently. I have not spoken to this client in a long time. And I just said, I've started a Netflix series, Interesting Calls, Human the World with It. I mean, it's, you know, I'm like, okay, who is this one person? And he's keeping me up, but he's thinking of me. He's got me in his phone with my name in it. I don't have his name in there, but it just says maybe, you know, Don Smith, let's just say. And he thought of me to share this new Netflix series about the parts of the brain is amazing with neuroplasticity. It might understand others. And I just wrote, well, thanks so much for thinking of me. You know, we maintained our relationship. He's texting, he's using great sentences. So yeah, we have to be careful what we wish for sometimes.
That's awesome. Well, always with a caveat. I love it.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. Well, we're going to wrap up today. Again, Abby, thank you so much. I want to remind all of our listeners to check out those show notes on speechuncensored.com for the links to some of the articles and the resources that we've talked about today, and the discussion guide for you guys to go and continue this discussion with your colleagues and talk about what you do, what the other folks do, and finding that, you know, sweet spot. Big thanks to Laura Miller for her terrific audio editing skills. And I'd be honored if you could post a thoughtful review on Apple Podcasts so other SLPs can find the podcast and join us on this journey. I'm so glad that you've decided to spend your time with the Speech Uncensored podcast today, and I hope that the material we've covered has nourished your mind so that your practice can flourish. Now get out there and be awesome.